Nee.
Professor Mayor,
Yeah.
would you mind uploading the PowerPoint today to Canvas?
It is actually there under files.
It's under files. In fact, I was revising it just before lecture today anyway. So I'll, as soon as I get back to my office, I'll post it.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry about that. Let's see. Yeah, I was actually working on it right up to the last minute because I was revising the presentation. But okay, so oops. Okay, so let's see. WebAssign problem set 8 was due today. I mean, due in the sense that I'm hoping you'd be able to compute determinants so you can follow computation of eigenvalues and eigenvectors in today's lecture. But do try to do problem set 8, if not tonight. Relatively soon, so that at least the calculation of determinants is several methods for doing so. Today, what we're going to do is discuss an application of determinants, really a principal application in this course. One of the main reasons you're in this course, presumably, is because your relative disciplines need you to understand how to solve eigenvector eigenvalue problems. I'm going to state this issue mathematically, but towards the end, I'll give applications on it. And the applications are really quite different than what you might expect. Here, for the first time, we have an application of linear algebra, which can only be solved using linear algebra, but it's surprising in the context of the problem you're solving. I'll give you an example, and I'll show you how it's related to eigenvectors and eigenvalues later. But if you have a three-dimensional object and you toss it in the air, it spins, right? And in fact, you can break that motion down into, rotation one way, rotation another, rotation. All right, there actually will be three separate axes of rotation that are natural for that object. Engineers need to understand that so they can see how torques balance on a particular object. Well, the way you can have a oddly shaped object like this desk or chair, finding those natural axes of rotation, how could you possibly do that? It's going to turn out that those natural axes of rotation are determined by as eigenvectors of a particular matrix. And in fact, the corresponding eigenvalues are going to be the moments of inertia around those particular axes of rotations. So there's a physical context in which the eigenvector eigenvalue problem that I'll state today has a direct application. But what we'll work with today is just the linear algebraic aspects of it, and I'll try to do applications later. You also can use eigenvectors and eigenvalues to solve differential equations. It's a pretty important concept in this course, so I want to do it properly. So we'll start by just stating what the mathematical problem is, and later in the week we'll get to applications. So it begins with a square matrix, and so let A be an n by n matrix. What we're looking for are numbers lambda and vectors that can be acted upon by that matrix. So it's an n by n matrix, a vector in an n-dimensional space. And what we want to do is this peculiar identity. We want matrix multiplication of the vector to be equivalent to scalar multiplication of the vector by a number. So right away, there's sort of a contradiction. You're doing two different things to that vector. One is matrix multiplication, the other is scalar multiplication, and we're demanding that those two actions on D are actually equivalent to one another. When that happens, this is only going to happen for special directions. Such directions are called eigenvectors of the matrix, and the corresponding numbers are going to be called eigenvalues. So here's an example. Here's a 2x2 matrix. Here's a two-dimensional vector. When I multiply the vector by the matrix and I calculate, I get a vector 4, 4, which is just the scalar multiple by the number 4 of the original vector. So here's an example of an eigenvector of the matrix A with eigenvalue 4. So that's the kind of phenomenon we're going to try to reproduce and find conditions for when that can happen. So again, the nomenclature is vectors that satisfy an equation like this are called eigenvectors. It's only going to work for a particular value, for particular numbers, lambda. Those particular numbers for which such equations have solutions, those are going to be called eigenvalues. And here I want to stress here that we're only interested in solutions where the vector v is not equal to the zero vector. Because the zero vector will work. You just put the zero vector on both sides, you have an identity. But that identity is just the zero vector is equal to zero vector once you calculate. So it's not really much information you can extract if you have a zero vector here. We're interested in the case when we have non-trivial solutions of that equation. All right, so some nomenclature here. Let's assume we have a number lambda so that we do have vectors that satisfy this equation. Then we can find all the vectors for a given lambda that satisfy the equation. Those are going to be called eigenvectors. And effectively, what the lambda eigenspace is going to be the set of all vectors for which lambda is an eigenvalue of all vectors v such that we say they have eigenvalue lambda. So it's the collection of all vectors that, once you fix lambda, this is the collection of all vectors that satisfy that condition. We call that the lambda eigenvector space. And now what I'm going to do is massage this a little bit so we get it into a more familiar setting. More familiar setting inside linear algebra. So here's the condition. We want matrix multiplication to be equivalent to scalar multiplication. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this term to the opposite side of the equation. And then this combination of terms, I'm going to try to get a common factor of V. So what I do is I insert the identity matrix in before that scalar multiplication. And then I have two matrices, A and lambda times I times V. I factorize that. And here's the equivalent condition. This condition is equivalent to saying that A minus lambda times the identity matrix, when it acts on an eigenvector, I get zero. So that makes it a little bit clearer what we're trying to do linear algebraically. To solve this, to find vectors V that satisfy an equation like this, well, it's equivalent to finding solutions of an equation like this, which is a homogeneous linear system. A coefficient matrix times a vector of unknown variables is equal to the zero vector. Homogeneous just means we have the zero vector on the right-hand side. Okay, so what you should notice here is that that coefficient matrix is not A itself. It's a kind of shifted version of the matrix A. What we're doing here is effectively subtracting from A, this matrix in its totality, is the matrix A, but where along the main diagonal, I've shifted the entries by an amount lambda. So that lambda shifting matrix is going to end up being the principal calculational object in the discussion. We'll be more often than not, we'll be looking at this matrix rather than the original matrix A, even when we're concerned with the eigenvectors and eigenvalues of A. All right, so in terms of the shifted matrix, the lambda eigenspace of a matrix A is exactly the null space of the shifted matrix. So here we can at least see how to calculate all the eigenvectors with eigenvalue A. We create this matrix and we find its null space. In other words, we solve this linear system in the usual fashion. Take this matrix, interpret it as a coefficient matrix, row reduce it to reducible echelon form, separate the free variables from the fixed variables, and write down the solution, expand in terms of the free variables, et cetera. Identifying the eigenspaces as the null space of the matrix, well, now we know how to do the calculation that will exhibit this explicitly. All right, so the main thing we got to do, though, is that for most values of lambda, it's going to turn out that they're the only solution of an equation like this is going to be the zero vector. And so the first thing I need to talk about a little bit is, first of all, let me step back a little bit. This lambda eigenspace, the set of all possible vectors that have eigenvalue lambda, set of all possible vectors that satisfy eigenvector eigenvalue problem, having identified that as the null space of a particular matrix, well, that identifies it as a subspace, right? The solution set of a homogeneous linear system is always a subspace. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to prove this lemma more directly, just so you see how this apparatus is working. So the claim is, once you have an eigenvalue and you look at the set of all possible solutions of A minus lambda I, X is equal to zero, creating the subspace, that it's, well, that creating that set of vectors is actually a subspace. So let's check that real quickly. Close your underscalar multiplication. Suppose B lives in the lambda eigenspace. Let's keep this theory up here. P lambda equals, and so keep everything up here at the same time. So A is a square matrix, and E lambda is going to be the set of vectors in Rn such that A times X is an eigenvector of A with eigenvalue lambda, which is the same thing as saying the vectors in Rn such that A minus lambda times the identity matrix times X is equal to zero. And to show that this is actually a subspace, it's a set of vectors, to show that it's a subspace, we need to show it's closed under scalar multiplication and vector addition. So suppose B is a vector that lives inside this set. B is an E lambda, means that A times B is equal to lambda times V. Well, so that's what I'm going to assume about this vector B. Let's look at a scalar multiple of it. So because scalar multiplication commutes with matrix addition, I can pull that factor through. But then since B is an eigenvalue of A with eigenvalue lambda, AV is equal to lambda V. And then I can just reverse the order of those scalar factors, and you see now that A times a scalar multiple of B is equal to lambda times the scalar multiple of V. So K times V satisfies the same condition. Acting on it by matrix multiplication is the same as scalar multiplication by lambda. And so K times V belongs to this set. So the set is closed under scalar multiplication. Similarly, if you have two vectors that start off in an eigenspace, you add them together, well, you can distribute that matrix multiplication across the vector sum. And in each case, since our hypothesis is that B1 and B2 are eigenvectors with eigenvalue lambda, we can replace A times, for example, B1 with lambda times B1. And then we can pull out the common factor of lambda, and we see that A times this vector is exactly equal to lambda times the same vector. And so B1 plus B2 is also living in that eigenspace. Having shown that it's closed under scalar multiplication, closed under a vector addition, we confirm that this subset of Rn is actually a subspace of Rn. All right, now, so this situation is going to bring up some semantic problems a little bit, because the way people are used to speaking when they are looking for eigenvectors is, well, what's going to happen? If you have an eigenvector, it's going to live in a subspace. And so you're always going to have, well, there's only one subspace that only has one vector. That's the zero vector. So the subspace that consists only of the zero vector, that is a subspace, but it's the one we're least interested in. More generally, if we have a subspace of Rn, well, zero dimension is just that point at the origin, but all the other subspaces are one-dimensional, two-dimensional, three-dimensional, or higher, and so they contain an infinite number of vectors. What we're really going to be looking for is when we speak of finding the eigenvectors of a matrix is not a single eigenvector, but generally we'll get, if we find any non-trivial solution, we're going to have infinitely many other solutions, but they're all going to lie in the same subspace. And so actually what we try to find when we specify this eigenspace is we try to find the basis vectors. We try to find the basis for this subspace. What you'll find when you leave this course, professor or paper is talking about finding the eigenvector of this matrix. What they really mean is one eigenvector, and maybe from the others you can generate the rest of the space. So typically when you say you solve the eigenvector problem, it's not that you write down every eigenvector. Well, for that, you'd have to formulate it as an infinite set like this. But usually, sort of sloppily, from a mathematical point of view, what you really want to do is find a basis for this subspace. And the common nomenclatures call that basis the eigenvectors corresponding to that eigenvalue. Okay, so let's review the problem here. The eigenvector eigenvalue problem is the problem of finding, first of all, the numbers such that these spaces are more than just the zero vector. We're looking for non-trivial solutions. So our first condition is we're looking for eigenvectors where the vector here is not the zero vector. That's too easy and it doesn't do us much good. We're looking for non-trivial solutions of that equation. And then, the way we'll proceed is we'll first figure out which numbers will work for us. For what numbers lambda do we have more than one solution of this condition or its equivalent condition here? And then once we find the eigenvalues, well, that's going to give us particular numbers. Now they're going to be values. It's not going to be a parameter that I denote by lambda. It'll be a specific number. Maybe the eigenvalue is 2, 3, or 4. The matrix A is generally always going to be a numerical matrix. So once I replace lambda here, thought of as initially as a parameter, when I replace it by a number, this becomes a concrete numerical matrix for which we can calculate with. So our first step before we can actually solve, find the eigenvectors to find the appropriate eigenvalues. Then, once we find an eigenvalue, then this becomes a concrete problem. This will be a particular number, and so this thing inside parentheses, it's just going to be a pure numerical matrix. And so we can solve that linear system to find the corresponding eigenvalues. Notice what's important here is we don't solve the system corresponding to A itself, but rather the shifted version of A. All right, so let's turn to the first part of the eigenvector eigenvalue problem, where the goal is to figure out what numbers lambda do we have eigenspaces which are more than one, consist of more than just the zero vector. We want to have non-zero vectors that satisfy that condition. All right, so I take the eigenvalue problem, I rephrase it into a form that's more familiar to us. Here's the eigenvector eigenvalue condition expressed as a homogeneous linear system. And what we're looking for are solutions of this system for which there's a solution other than x equals zero. All right, so what does it mean? How do we impose this condition? How do we make sure that the solutions of this linear system have solutions other than the trivial solution? Well, we have to step back to just before the first midterm, where we discussed the fundamental theorem of invertible matrices. It told us that anytime we had a square matrix, then the following statements are equivalent, that A has an inverse, that every linear system, AX equals B, has a unique solution, that X equals zero is the unique solution to AX is equal to zero, that the row, reduced row echelon form of the matrix is the identity matrix. And as we've seen in last week's lecture, that the determinant of A, that should have been not equal to zero. Determinant A not equal to zero guarantees that a matrix has an inverse. Now those first four terms, we proved this right before the first midterm, and what it had to do with, the way we connected these three statements, is it all had to do with essentially where the pivots live in a reduced row echelon form of a matrix. First of all, a matrix is only going to have an inverse when it can be row reduced to the identity matrix. That's effectively connected here. And then once you have an inverse of a matrix, you can easily solve the system by multiplying both sides by the inverse. And in particular, if you have an inverse of a matrix, you can multiply both sides of this system by A the minus first, and you find that X has to equal the zero vector. So these first four statements, we uncovered that as soon as we understood how to calculate the inverse of a matrix and relate it to, for example, solving linear systems. But what we did last week in our discussion of the determinants is we used determinants to detect whether or not a matrix was invertible. So if any one of these statements is true, then all four of the other statements is also true. But that also means that if any one of these statements is false, all the other statements are false. Now, what we're looking for are non-trivial vectors that satisfy an equation like this. Well, here's, think of this as a coefficient matrix rather than just A itself. If this linear system is going to have non-trivial, it's going to have only the trivial solution, then we're going to need the determinant of A to not equal zero. But if X equals zero is going to, if we're going to have solutions other than X equals zero, so I'm negating statement three, the negation of statement five would be the determinant of A is equal to zero. And so that's how we'll determine the appropriate values of lambda. The only time this equation here is going to have non-trivial solution is when the determinant of this entire coefficient matrix, when that is equal to zero. All right, so here's the statement. A homogeneous linear system has a non-trivial solution, solutions other than the zero vector, only when the determinant of the matrix is equal to zero. And now we can apply this to our eigenvector value problem. What we're looking for, got lots of typos here. We need looking for a non-trivial solution of that equation. Well, that's going to require the determinant of this matrix to equal zero. Okay, how do we utilize that? As we've seen, and hopefully as you've calculated in your homework, that the determinant of a matrix is always a polynomial in the entries of a matrix. So in particular, once I shift A, say A is equal to 2, 1, 1, 3, then A minus lambda times I, what that matrix is, it's just the original matrix where I've shifted the diagonal elements by the parameter lambda. Now when I take a determinant of this matrix, it's going to be a polynomial in the lambda, because this 2 minus lambda times 3 minus lambda minus 1 times 1. It's going to end up being a polynomial, but that determinant is going to have to equal 0. So what happens is we end up with a polynomial equation. It'll be a polynomial in the parameter lambda. A itself contains only numbers. What we're adding to the problem is a new parameter lambda. When we calculate the determinant, A minus lambda I, what it works out to be is 2 minus lambda, 3 minus lambda, minus 1, i.e., a polynomial in lambda. And setting that determinant equal to zero means we have to solve a polynomial equation. So in fact, we effectively leave linear algebra for a minute. We have to consider ordinary algebra where we're considering how we solve polynomial equations. All right, so this is the most important equation right now. To determine the numbers lambda for which we'll have non-trivial eigenvectors, that's going to require us to solve a certain polynomial equation. We call that polynomial equation the characteristic equation for A. And the solutions of this equation, the numbers lambda for which this is aptly true, those are going to be exactly the eigenvalues of A. Okay. So here I'm repeating that. Let's do an explicit example. Okay, so here's a 2x2 matrix. I don't know anything about it yet. What I'm going to try to do is figure out the numbers lambda such that I'll have non-trivial eigenvectors. All right, so first we'll calculate this so-called characteristic polynomial. This expression here is called the characteristic polynomial of the matrix A. It depends on A but it's a polynomial in this offsetting parameter lambda. So we calculate it. We have to take the determinant of A minus lambda times the identity matrix. The addition of this term, all it does to the original matrix is it shifts the elements along the main diagonal from the upper left to the lower right. It shifts it by an amount lambda. But now we can calculate determinants in the usual fashion. Here I'll use the difference of diagonal products to compute the determinant of that 2x2 matrix. And it works out to be a certain polynomial in lambda. And now let me remind you that to solve polynomial equations, the typical procedure is to try to factorize this polynomial in terms of linear polynomials. So lambda squared minus 2 lambda minus 8 you should know from just high school algebra that this thing will factorize as lambda minus 4 times lambda plus 2. And so the solution set of determinant A minus lambda I is equal to 0. Well, here's that determinant explicitly calculated, and it's only going to equal 0 when one of these factors is equal to 0. So either we need lambda equal to 4 or lambda to equal 2. So that's the eigenvalues of A are exactly the numbers 4 and negative 2. All right, so if you have a polynomial that's quadratic, you actually have a couple ways of solving the corresponding polynomial equations. For quadratic polynomials, you have the quadratic formula. That will always give you solutions. But more generally, what you try to do for higher order polynomials for which there is no analog of the quadratic equation, the way you find solutions to a polynomial equation is you achieve that by factorizing the polynomial. And in fact, the fundamental theorem of algebra is the statement that if you have a polynomial of degree n, then there is always a complete factorization in terms of linear polynomials. So that if you have some arbitrary polynomial, a n x to the n plus dot 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 plus a zero, if that's your polynomial, then the fundamental theorem of algebra says that this arbitrary polynomial is always going to have a complete factorization in terms of linear polynomials, where the degree of each factor is just degree one in the underlying variable. And what happens once you achieve this factorization is that the solutions of the corresponding polynomial equation, p of x is equal to zero, they're going to be exactly these offsets of your variable. So effectively, you solve polynomial equations by guessing or constructing a factorization of the polynomial. Oh, I should point out, though, this is the one point in the course where complex numbers are sometimes unavoidable. What I didn't state explicitly in this theorem is that the only way you guarantee that you can always get this factorization is you have to be able to admit complex numbers. For example, the polynomial equation x squared plus 1 is equal to 0, it has no real solutions. But x equals plus or minus I equals plus or minus the square root of minus 1, this will satisfy the equation. And in fact, this polynomial factorizes this lambda minus I, lambda plus I. So in fact, this polynomial, indeed, that does have a factorization, but it doesn't have a factorization necessarily over the real numbers. Now, in this course, we try to avoid complex numbers because it makes computations much more strenuous. But in fact, everything you've learned in linear algebra, if you replace the real numbers by the complex numbers, it would still work. You can still write down a matrix which, instead of having real numbers as entries, you have complex numbers as entries. You can solve linear systems where the coefficients are complex numbers, what will happen, though, is that generally when you solve a system of linear equations with complex coefficients, is that your solutions end up being complex numbers as well. But what's really happening here is the overall linear algebra is exactly the same. Even if I was solving a linear system with complex numbers in it, that method of row reduction, using row reduction to solve the linear system, is exactly the same, except for the point where you actually get down to the computations and you start multiplying numbers or adding numbers together. That's where the complexity of the complex numbers come in. But the formalism is exactly the same. It's only at the base level computations where you're using arithmetic that you see a difference. But as you know, if you've ever dealt with complex numbers, it's more tedious to deal with multiplication and addition of complex numbers because you have the real part and imaginary part to constantly keep separate and keep track of. In this course, we try to avoid complications of complex numbers, and we keep things simple by keeping things real. And usually, you'll notice in homework problems and exam problems, I even usually specialize the integers because they're even easier to add. So the reason why we avoid complex numbers in this course is simply because the calculations become more tedious, but the theory is exactly the same. Okay, so just a little warning. I will a little bit later in the week show you that for some matrices, complex eigenvalues are unavoidable. But I'm going to sidestep that issue for as long as I can, just to show you how the apparatus works. All right, so let's start with another example. We'll try to find the eigenvalues of the matrix. This time it's going to be a 3x3 matrix. Now, remember that the determinant of a polynomial is the determinant of a matrix is always a polynomial of the same degree as the matrix size. So if I have a 3x3 matrix, what I should expect when I calculate its determinant is going to be a polynomial of degree 3. And so let's take this matrix. We'll shift it along the diagonal by a parameter negative lambda, and we'll calculate its determinant. This polynomial that will result is the characteristic polynomial of the original matrix A. Well, so here we'll do a cofactor expansion, along the second row. So we have this would be, I'll write more detail here. This should be the zero entry times minus one to the, in this slot, it's in the second row, first column. And then I have the determinant, the corresponding minor, but I'm not going to compute it because it's being multiplied by zero. Then I have the second term, which is 0 minus lambda times minus 1 to the 2 plus 2. Now I have a non-zero trivial term, so let's actually write down that matrix. It's exactly here. 1 minus lambda. So what I'm doing here is I'm ignoring the row and column here. 1 minus lambda, 1 minus lambda. And then I have pick up the term in the cofactor expansion corresponding to the third element in the second row, and that will be exactly this. I get a minus sign here because I'll have 1 times minus 1. This guy here is in the second row, third column, so it'll be minus 1 to an odd power. That's where that minus sign comes from. And then this is the minor we get by ignoring, removing the column and row that contains the item of the entry of interest. All right, so that's a review of that determinant calculation, how it's set up. And then once we simplify, here we do the direct calculation. So these 2x2 matrices, I'm just using the difference of the diagonal products to calculate the determinants. And then once I simplify, I get, as predicted, a polynomial of degree 3. Polynomial of degree 3 in the parameter lambda. All right, so now we have a problem. For polynomials of degree 3 or polynomials of degree 4, we don't have anything like the quadratic formula that is a simple solution for immediately writing down all possible solutions of the polynomial equation. Rather, we have some polynomial that we're going to, the only way we can figure out how to solve this, find the values of lambda for which PA of lambda is equal to zero, so we're going to have to factorize this. For cubics, it's usually not so, not like quadratic equations where, generally speaking, you can, if you see a nice pattern of the coefficients, you can factorize it. Rather, in the case at hand, what we'll have to do is, first of all, identify one easy factor. All terms here are proportional to lambda. So that means two things. It means lambda equals zero has to be a root. Because if lambda equals zero, it's pretty obvious that the right-hand side is going to evaluate to zero when lambda is equal to zero. And so lambda will be a solution. But to find the other solutions, what we'll do is we'll pull out the common factor of lambda. And now we'll try to factorize this quadratic polynomial. And that's easier to do. I can recognize this as lambda minus 2 times lambda plus 1. And so the full factorization of our characteristic polynomial is going to be minus lambda times lambda minus 2 times lambda plus 1. And from this factorization, we can read off the eigenvalues. For this polynomial to equal 0, we either need lambda equal to 0, lambda equal to 2, or lambda equal to negative 1. And so those are the eigenvalues. All right. That's the only new part that you'll have to learn for the eigenvector eigenvalue problem. And it's pretty simple. Given a matrix A, so to find the eigenvalues, the first thing you do is you form the shifted matrix A, which is A minus lambda I. You just subtract lambda, the parameter lambda from the diagonal entries of A. And then you compute a polynomial, PA of lambda, which is going to be defined as the determinant of the shifted matrix. And then what you do is you factorize PA of lambda to identify the eigenvalues. Okay, but the eigenvector eigenvalue problem has two parts. We've only solved the first part. We found the allowable eigenvalues for a given matrix following this procedure. To find the eigenvalues, well, what we do is we take one of the solutions that we found here. Now lambda is no longer a parameter. We're interpreting it as a number. One of the roots of the characteristic equation. And then we get, when lambda is a number, this becomes a concrete numerical matrix, and we can thereby use row reduction and the like to explicitly find the solutions. And then we've got the corresponding eigenvectors. So we finish the eigenvector eigenvalue problem by, once we've got the eigenvalues, we substitute them in one by one. So in this, I'm now interpreting lambda as a particular number, a particular root of the characteristic equation. That'll be a numerical matrix that I reduce to row echelon form. Once I get that, I can look at the columns that have pivots and the columns that don't have pivots to distinguish between fixed variables and free variables. I can write down the equations corresponding to the reduced row echelon form, express the fixed variables in terms of the free variables, write down a typical solution vector, expand that solution in terms of the free parameters, and then the constant vectors that are being multiplied by the free parameters, those are going to be your basis vectors for the solution set. They will be a basis for your eigenspace, and those are what we'll call the eigenvectors of A. We'll actually be looking for these basis vectors. Okay, so yeah.
So is that eigenvalue
whenever we find the basis vector, is that the basis vector for the other eigenvalue as well, or?
No, no. So for each eigenvalue, you're going to have to do a separate, you're going to have to solve a separate linear system. Every time you change this number, the solution, the equations change, and you have to resolve the system.
So there's multiple basis vectors.
Yeah. But typically what will happen, though, is, typically what happens is you'll have a unique basis vector because the solution set will be one-dimensional. And so there's only one direction in that entire eigenspace. You usually just want to find that one direction. That kind of fits with the physical interpretation of our solutions, where I described that problem of finding the natural axes of rotations. Those axes of rotations, they're really determined by a direction, not by the length of the vector, but just the direction it's going in space. That's usually what one means by the eigenvectors. You're looking for those directions, not necessarily unique vectors, but unique directions. Okay, so I guess I'll stop here today. What we'll do on Wednesday is we'll explicitly find some eigenvectors and begin solving several examples of eigenvector, eigenvalue problems.